Paul's going to talk to us today about some of his work in large-scale SLAM. Paul is a university lecturer at Oxford University, Department of Engineering Science. I looked at the Oxford webpage today just to figure out how old Oxford is, and there's a slogan that kind of looks like serving the educational needs of English-speaking humanity for 900 years.
Yeah.
That's my paraphrase of it. So Paul's been doing work in mobile robots for a long time. He's worked in SLAM for a long time. Probably all of you know his name from SLAM papers. Lately, he's worked also in vision for SLAM and for mapping. He's done work in guidance. He's done ground vehicles. He's done underwater vehicles. I don't know if you've done air vehicles.
Scary.
Too scary.
Yeah. England's too small. They'll just fly off the edge, right?
Okay, so take it away, Paul.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much, Al, for inviting me. It's a real pleasure to be here. I was here almost exactly 10 years ago, and of all the things I said then, none of them are now true. So I hope that doesn't repeat. So maybe in 5 years, this stuff will still be true. I think it will. So I'm going to talk about large-scale SLAM. But we're not going to be talking about large-scale metric SLAM. We're going to be talking about large-scale topological SLAM. Now, normally, I give talks and people go, what is this SLAM of which you speak? Okay, now I'm thinking, can we have a quick show of hands? SLAM is, you're au fait with SLAM? More than 90% au fait with SLAM? Stick your hand up so I know. Okay, fantastic. So we can scoot pretty quickly through the opening slides. So the first slide, why might we want to navigate? I mean, of all the places to not have to explain why we'd like a machine to navigate, this would be one of it. So I'm not actually going to speak about any of the bullet points on there, but it's quite a nice picture of the satellites, I think. So, okay. And I think you know about the SLAM problem, okay? So this is something that has obsessed me for too long. It's time to move on. It really is. I keep telling myself that every new year, new problem, new problem. Here, just one more iteration, and this time we'll really get it to go. And it's an information engineering problem that not only obsesses me, but is central, I think, to mobile robotics. So what are the kind of things that we can do? Well, we know the mathematics now. We know how to phrase the problem, that it's a Bayesian problem. All good things are Bayesian. And from this set of slides, you don't need to parse that. All good things are Bayesian, and all good algorithms come from Bayesian things. So, you know, we could decide, if we wanted to try and minimize this. We could say, well, come up with the x hat, that's the state, that is minimized mean squared error. Okay, that might be something we want to do. So I would like to come up with an estimate that on average is the closest to the truth. That seems a sensible thing to do. And you could then, there's a nice little bit of calculus that says, well, the best thing to do is just calculate the expected mean. And you say, okay, that's great. I just need to take the average of things. And you say, well, I'd like to take the average of a Gaussian. And if you do that, you end up with a Kalman filter. You could go a different way. You could say, well, I'm going to do particle filters. And you're going to end up with Rao-Blackwellized Kalman filters. Excellent. Fast SLAM. Many ways in which you can take the Bayesian formulation that I think we're probably familiar with, and I'm not going to spend time droning on about, to come up with implementations that do SLAM over some reasonable but not very impressive scale. So one way is you can propagate the first and second order row moments, and you have a Kalman filter. You could propagate the inverse of those, and you have an information filter. In particular, something I'm very fond of is Ryan Eustace's exactly sparse delayed state information filter. It trips off the tongue very easily, that one, and it's good to have a nice moniker. Okay. So we should be used to seeing this kind of thing. We should not be surprised to see this kind of video. And it's nice, because this, I think, 8 years ago would have been breathtaking. Now it's, yeah, bothered am I? Yeah? We should not be impressed by this kind of navigation, even though we all have a little of a bit of a shine in us when we actually get something that to really work, when someone who's giving you money is in the room. Okay, and of course that's exactly when it doesn't work. Okay, so we won't go slowly through the whole thing. It will have a bit of a time warp effect here now. And this is the information engineering building. The day before, everyone moved all their rubbish into the labs. We got down there and built these kind of things. Okay, so what's the deal? We've done this SLAM problem, right? Well, that's a reasonable size map. That's probably only 50, 60 meters. And we can start to thinking about going outdoors with a nodding sensor. And we could start to do some 3D SLAM outdoors. So now we could take our 2D laser scanners, and we could start to bob them up and down. And we could worry about timing, and we could do some systems integration, and we could feel proud about our systems integration, and we can start to build some 3D maps. So great. So now we've gone from indoors to outdoors, and our particle filters or our Kalman filters or our information filters, whatever our favorite flavor of the day is, we can extend to be 6 degrees of freedom, and we can start to build some larger outdoor maps. And we could try and go really quite large scale. Now, this is trying to do this over kilometres. Daniel Huber's here, so you've seen point clouds far, far better than this. This is a homebrew. And it looks quite nice. Now, don't forget that your wetware is assembling that into a nice image of a city. There's nothing about that that has any inherent structure. It's just a 3 by very big number matrix. It's a very big matrix, even if you make it integers. Okay. So, I like this. This guy has been immortalized here, taking a photo. Little did this guy know that I keep talking about him. So, I'd really like to do that kind of mapping around the whole of Oxford. Of course, we'd never go to Cambridge. There are other cities that you want to do apart from one in particular, Fentech. Okay, so we wouldn't really want to talk about that. But there's trouble. So, when we come back to the same place, here you go. This is the vehicle trajectory ellipsoid. Okay, so further away from the origin, it's bigger. And there's this discontinuity here. Okay, now we know that this place is the same as this place. How do you know that? Right, well, because you've never come across what do you call them here? Pavements?
Sidewalks,
yeah, because pavements are not sidewalks. Yeah, it's exactly the opposite. you never come across a place that you walk where cars aren't, okay, that has a 12-foot discontinuity. I'm sorry, I'm right in your way. Are you okay with me wandering in the way? Okay, so you know that it's back at the same place, and you know you're back at the same place because you have all this prior knowledge that pavements don't tend to do that unless you're in some kind of crazy Escher-like world, okay, then it just truly is confusing. So this is the loop closure problem, and this is a serious problem with SLAM. This is where things break. Is I can be as clever as I like with my SLAM algorithm, and I posit that I will always be able to break it. Why? Because I have to put my money down on a representation of those probabilities that this talk started with. I have to say it's a mixture of Gaussians, or it's a single Gaussian, it's a canonical form Gaussian, it's a particle filter. So all of these, I'm making assumptions. It's a particle filter, and I've only got these many particles that I can propagate. You're putting your money down on the representation, and I posit I'll always be able to find a representation, a workspace I could send you through where you commit some small error that in the end will mean you will commit something gross. Okay, small error or compound. Here you go. We had a little fracas with a cleaning lady here as we were going around this building. This isn't particularly impressive. This is probably 30 meters, 60 meters. Apologies for no scale, but trust me, it's of that order. And there was a fraction of a degree error here. And then you do a long traverse, and of course, angular errors composed into large metric errors over long traversals, and you're in trouble. What am I drawing here? This is the 5 sigma bound on the position of the vehicle. So I forget. I can't do the integration in my head, but of a Gaussian, a 5 sigma bound, it's something like 1 in a million or something, the vehicle's saying it's there. And of course, we know it is. We know it's there. How do we know it's there? Because, we just recognize it. We just recognize it. Independently of the metric picture, we're going, this place, look, there's this little thing coming off here. It's clearly the same, and you've gone around in a loop. So we need to fix this loop closure problem, because it's always going to bite you. Okay, you might be really pleased, and you can do 2 kilometers. Congratulations, I bet you couldn't do 20. You can do 20, congratulations, I bet you can't do 200. I don't need to do 200, yes you do, because you're going to keep going around forever. Because I'd like you to have a SLAM algorithm that works for weeks, not just because there's a conference deadline on the Monday, so you better do the demo on the Friday afternoon. You know, if we want long-term persistence, we're going to have to nail this problem. So here's a central argument. Loop closing's hard precisely because of metric problems. Okay, you can't use metric inference to try and figure out, have I got a loop closing? This is what we were doing before for too long, I think. Is we're saying, I'm really proud of my statistics, and my statistics say I'm in this ellipse here, so I better look through that ellipse to find where I am. But the fact that you've got to look for where you are means your metric reasoning has gone wrong. Okay, so it's this self-referential incestual circle. I mean, perhaps to put it a bit strongly. In fact, the editor of a paper I wrote did say perhaps that's stating it too strongly. They had a point, but, you know, it gets a smile. Okay, so we need something. We need some sort of sibling process that just says you are where you have been before, independently of metric. Just I just recognize this place. How many of you have been to Siena? Okay, so imagine you're not here. Okay, Siena's very long and bendy. Okay, you think it's a straight road, but the roads kind of curve a little bit. And you think you're walking halfway to Rome, suddenly you go, oh, I'm back at the piazza. I just recognize it. So my metric idea in my head was just wrong. Okay, but I entertain the possibility, because things just look so damn similar, that I'm back at the same place. And then in my head, I said, that road must have been kind of bendy. And if you have that idea in your head, that's exactly what we're going to be talking about, those topological constraints. We need to reason about the scene appearance and not scene whereabouts. And that's what we're going to be talking about. So, let's start. What do we mean by appearance? Well, I'm going to cover that in a couple of slides so we're all on the same page. So, because appearance can be interpreted in many ways, and I'm going to try and narrow it down for what I'm talking for about this talk. And appearance is the agglomeration of quantized patch descriptors. Well, that's a bit vague, so we'll nail that down. So terms of reference, I choose this learned tome advisedly, not simply because it comes from a fine stable, but because we're talking about dictionaries. And we're going to be talking a little bit about the visual Google way of reasoning. So here you go, very quickly through how we're going to use our substrate on which we're going to build the rest of this talk. Take an image and go to your software library and please extract your favorite region of interest detector. Okay, I would like your region of interest detector to be wide baseline stable. So you could use Gini-Matisse's maximally stable extremal regions. You could use Harris Affine. You could, if you wanted to, use Dave Lowe's SIF detector, not necessarily the descriptor, but the detector. And that's going to find some regions of interest that you think are going to kind of look similar over different viewpoints. Fine. Take those and encode them somehow. Okay, now you could encode them with just a histogram, you could use a SIFT. We actually use SURF now, the SURF descriptor, which is 32D. So for every little patch, I've got a region that describes where the ellipse is and a descriptor. So some scene IU. Now I'm talking about scenes. Why is he not talking about images, I hear you say? Because there's nothing about this talk that's coupled to vision. In fact, I'm a man without vision, okay? It's just that it's nice here for this talk to talk about using camera images. And we do mostly use camera images, but just have in the back of your mind that there's nothing that I'm talking about that's specifically anchored to images. It can be done, and we have done it with laser data, but it's easier to show pictures. So scene and image are interchangeable for this talk. So now some scene IU produces N descriptors. And N is dependent on the captured scene. Some, if I just took a picture of that, I probably wouldn't get many, but I took one outside in Pittsburgh, I might get lots of regions of interest. It depends on the tool that you're using. So what I could do, say I was using SIFT, so it was 128D, I could get myself some very expensive 128D graph paper, it's rare, and plot all of those descriptors in a high D space, okay? And you'll find that they cluster. Okay. Well, why do they cluster? Well, it's because the world isn't a noise field. Okay. The world does have structure. Straight lines occur. Corners occur. Leaves occur. There's not an infinite variation of the kind of things that you see in pictures. And they tend to cluster. So we could take the cluster centers of these guys and call these words. Now, this up to here is very much in the spirit of Visual Google by Zisserman and Civic, which is their IJCV paper in 2003. So let's bear in mind what we're doing. I've taken a whole load of training images. I just trawled the net for images, and I've taken all the regions of interest detectors, I've turned them into descriptors, and I've clustered them. And I'm going to call the center of the clusters words. Okay? Now, some words may be more informative than others because they're rarer. Okay? So if you did a search, you know, the University of Oxford, which I'm sure is a search you do often, Google will return and will say, "The" is a common word that's been removed from your search because it's pretty much content-free. It occurs the whole time. So we could, if we chose, give these words weighting. And Sparchek Jones, in the Journal of Library Science, interestingly, came up with a very nice weighting scheme to say how important particular words may be as a function of how common they are in the corpus at which they're occurring. So we could give them a weight if you wanted to. Okay, so what do we do when a new image comes in? So we've built what we call our vocabulary. We've taken maybe 20,000, 30,000 training images, and we have built a vocabulary, okay, of words, of these centers, of these clusters where these things occur. So I take some now new image coming in, and I'm going to turn that into a document. And I turn it into a document by taking every descriptor and snapping it, quantizing it onto the nearest word. Okay, so now what I could do is I can turn an image into a long vector. Okay? And if you were naive, that vector would be the length of your vocabulary with lots of zeros in it. The only place there wouldn't be zeros is where word I occurs. Okay? And it might be a one there if you haven't got weighting, or a weight if the word really does occur. So if I had 400, took a photo over there, I might get 400 features lighting up, or region of interest would light up in 400 places. I would then snap those onto the nearest 400 words, and I would get a vector with 20,000 long, if I have a 20,000 long vocabulary, with 400 non-zero entries. Okay, so this then is an appearance representation of our image. Okay, and that's how we're going to move forward with that. Okay, so to put this in context, it's good to talk about some previous loop closing work, just for three or four slides, using that appearance-based method. And this was work that was good up to 2006, and with that we could do a couple of kilometers. Okay, so we could move a robot outside for a couple of kilometers, and it would work. And I think it's good to see what we could do with appearance-based reasoning without any metric information. So here's the idea. I want to recognize I've come back to the same place. So I take a stream of images, and a new image comes in. The obvious thing to do is say, how like is this image to all the previous images? Okay. So one thing to do is do the dot product between the appearance vectors, right? Because if they've got nothing in common, they're in 128D space, but where one's got a 0, the other one's got a 1, or they've got 2 zeros. There's nothing in common. Okay. And if they're exactly the same images, the dot product will be 1. Okay. So, and we're normalizing these vectors. So now I've got a similarity measure between two images, and that's very nice. I've got two images, and I've converted them to documents, and I've got a similarity measure between them. So what do all good information engineers do? We get it into a matrix as soon as possible. Okay? Quick, draw a matrix. Okay? So we do draw a matrix, and this every element ij of this matrix is the similarity between image I and image j. Okay? And you better believe there's a strong line up the middle. There's a MATLAB shading artifact here that should be 1 all the way down the middle. It is. Okay, I promise you. It's not the time to lie here. Okay? So, because every image is self-similar. But what about this? What's this? This is a loop closure showing up. It's because image 100 is like image 300, and image 301 is like image 101, and so on. So what I should do is I should build myself a streak detector, okay, that can detect streaks of these matrices, say there's a loop closure. Okay? Well, that seems like a good thing to do. And the loop closures do appear as off-diagonal traces. But cutting a one-hour talk down to 3 minutes on this previous work, there's trouble at mill. Okay? What happens when you take this thing to a park is you see leaves everywhere. Okay? Everything's a bit leafy. Okay? Everything's a bit green, and everything's very confusing. Okay? So my student was furious with me, because he had a brilliant idea, and it was broken within a day. But what's the second thing you do? So the loop closures are here. Okay? They're actually hidden in here, but there's other much stronger signals through this matrix. And that's because image I is like lots of other images, because they're all a bit leafy, as I said. So what's the second thing you do as an information engineer when you've got a matrix is you take its singular value decomposition. Okay, that's always got to be a good plan, it seems. Okay. And if you do follow the good plan theorem through, something extraordinary happens. It's known, so the similarity matrix is all positive and symmetric. And so I can write it as a sum of dyads over its eigenvectors. Okay, so I can decompose any matrix as a sum of its weighted eigenvectors with the outer product of its eigenvectors. So this is summing over lambda 1, the first eigenvalue, times the first eigenvalue times the transpose. That gives me a matrix of rank 1. Okay, so here's me expanding out that matrix. Okay, here's the matrix, the similarity matrix. That's equal to the first dyad plus the second, the third, and the fourth. Hey, look, this one's captured a lot of the structure. And this one plus this one captures even more of the structure. Okay? Well, this is because the best rank R approximation to a given matrix M, okay, is given by summing over the first R dyads. Okay? And what I mean best approximation is that minimizes the Frobenius norm. Okay, so this is a nice result from linear algebra, and I'm sure you all know it. So the question, now we have a cunning plan. Okay? Our cunning plan is as follows. Why don't we remove the first K dyads from our matrix? And we're subtracting out the strong structure. Because by definition, the first n dyads are the best approximation to that matrix. So what we should be left with is the little detail, which is what we want for those streaks. The question now is, how do I figure out what k eigenvalues to remove? I can't go into it now. It turns out there's a nice entropy argument that you compose, and you get these kind of nice looking graphs. And at the peak, you can say that's how many you should remove. And so this is in an IJCV special issue between IJRR and IJCV on robotics and vision. And so if you want the details, you can look at it in there. So we can remove the first 4, this says, for this particular data set. And you do that, and you end up with this. Okay, so there's the original matrix, and there's this. Now, this data is faked in the following way. I've gone through and shaded in the loop closures that it finds, so it just shows up so you don't see a white square. Okay, so I have shaded that in. It is stronger than you would expect. But we can still find those. Okay, so that looks great. Okay, but there's still trouble at mill. So we've solved the perceptual aliasing problem. We did that quite nicely. Previous method's fine for a few thousand images, say a couple of kilometers. But for spectral decomposition, it's brutal for large n. So it's n cubed in the number of places I've been. So we could run this online around building sites. Fantastic. We couldn't run it around cities because it was starting to run too far behind time and the cubic thing really started to hit us. But worse still, for someone whose second slide was about Bayes, okay, there's very little probability theory in here. There was some in terms of checking how strong the loop closures are, how sure we are we've got a loop closure, but not enough. There was no way I could fuse data from a camera and from a sonar and from an infrared camera and a radar, okay, because the similarity matrix was for the modality of the sensor. So this didn't feel very good. And worse still, there was no sensor model. There was no way for me to say, how noisy is my camera, and take that into account. And I absolutely needed to have that. So where did we start thinking about this? Well, it was after ICRO, and we just presented this paper. We were very happy. The paper had gone down well. So I sat with my student at the airport lounge, waiting for a flight back from Florida, and said, right, clean piece of paper. What's wrong with it? Let's start from scratch. And we had a very, very good conversation. In fact, such a good conversation that we missed our flight, and we were actually at the gate. Everyone got up past us, left, and we looked up after 3.5 hours and said, where'd everyone go? And we had to go to the gate and say, look, you can call me Muppet every other word, but we've really got to get home. And you've seen in their faces, they couldn't believe these academics. But this is where the FabMap stuff started from, was that one good conversation with a student of mine, Mark Cummins. So, and we call it FabMap. Who's heard of Absolute Fabulous, the comedy? Yeah, AbFab is the second algorithm, and it's coming up in part five. So, okay. So this is fast appearance-based mapping. Okay, and it addresses the loop closing problem absolutely, but more than that, it produces topological maps as well. Okay, instead of just saying I'm back where I was, it produces a graph of places. So let's begin with that. In fact, I might just have a swig of coffee. Excuse me. Okay. And the take-home point of this algorithm is: bear in mind the previous one was O n cubed, where n is the number of places. This is O n. Okay, with a small constant in front of it. It's very fast, and we can really run this online. Okay, now, I haven't said, please, if you get a bit, if I go too swiftly, I do talk quite fast, and some of the nomenclature needs just clarifying what you've forgotten. Please do stick your hand up, okay? It's much better if it's interactive at this point. Okay, so here is going to be my representation of the world, not metric anymore. It's going to be a bunch of places. Here is a place, and this is another place, okay? I've got no idea of the metric link between the two of them. They're just different places, and they have different, but hopefully overlapping views, okay? That's all I mean. And I'm going to call places locations, and they're going to be notated with a L, and L sub I's location I, because I'm going to have lots of I, hopefully, you know, tens, hundreds of thousands of I. Now, what's this model of a place? This is something that was completely missing before. A model of a place. How do I represent a representation of this place? Well, what we're going to do is if we had 20,000 words in our vocabulary, we're going to say a place, if we're going to do this naively and implement it, is a vector 20,000 long, where every element is the probability that at that place, something exists that, if viewed by a camera, would generate word I. So PE1 given LI means that at place LI, there is something existing, something hidden, that when you swing a camera at it, tends to produce word 1. Okay, and it's the probability of that thing being there. So these are our hidden variables. These are things that are generating the things that we see in the camera. This is what's going to allow us to have our sensor model in a moment. So this is our model of a place. It's a list of probabilities that word generators exist at place I. Well, what's a word generator? If you like, think about it. So I have a word maybe for this guy over here. Word 7009, it looks like to me. Okay. Doesn't really. Okay. And the generator is edge. Okay, that there would be an edge there. I just call it the generator for word 7009. But you can think of it as words that correspond to edges have edges in the real world. But I don't always see edges in the camera, even if there's an edge there. So it allows me to bring the sensor model into it. So here is the observation model. I take an image of this place. Okay, I do my quantization again into the dictionary. I think of this quantization step as spell checking. That's why I think of it. You know, you get a descriptor that's close to a word, and it snaps onto the closest word. So think of it as spell checking. So you end up with a well-spelled document. Okay, and the vector now is the observation vector is a binary vector: 0 if the word never occurs, and 1 if word I does occur. Okay, so if I had 400 things, okay, I would have 400 words in there, so long as they're all unique. I could have some words occurring twice, and I would still just get a 1 in the observation vector. We're all okay with this setup so far? Yeah? Okay. Now here's where the fun comes. Now I can write a sensor model down. I can write down the sensor model parameterized by these two terms. The probability of observing, this is a mistake. This should be Z sub I. Okay? This should be the probability of observing a word given that its generator really exists in the world. Okay, so that's how good the sensor is. If that's low, it keeps missing things that are really there. And also the probability of observing Z sub I, given that it's not exist, so that's a false positive. It's just generating spurious words, and that should be a low number. And those two numbers we can use to parameterize our sensor. Okay, because it's conditioned on whether this generator is there or not. So here's what we want to do now for topological mapping. Where are we? Are we at a place we've already seen before, or are we at a new place? Okay. So you might say, well, how do you initialize a place? Well, just I can initialize that with the marginals of just these words ever existing, taken over all my training data set. So don't worry about initialization. I wish I hadn't said that now. Forget about initialization. Think about this graph. I'm somewhere here. A new observation comes in, and I want to evaluate the probability that I'm at each of these places, given all the measurements that I ever come in. Right, so notation. This curly Z super K, that is the set of all observations that have ever occurred up until time K. Okay, and that's what I want to do. So I'd like to, what's the probability I'm at LF, given all my observations? And what is the probability I'm at LG, given all my observations? And also, what is the probability I'm at L star, some new place that I'd never been? And that's what makes this problem quite tricky. Kidnap robot, in some ways, is a much easier problem because someone's saying you have a closed universe, you are at one of these n places. Which one? Okay? But it's harder to say you're at one of these previous places, maybe, or it could just be a new place. Okay? And that's the thing we're going to have to think hard about how we're going to do. Okay? Now, Bayes' rule allows us to write this down. Imagine we could come up with an observation model of all of the features that we see conditioned on a place. Bayes' rule allows us to flip that round to get the probability of a place given all the measurements. Okay, so standard out-the-bag Bayes' rule. Well, the first thing we should do then is think about how we're going to generate this observation likelihood. So, first thing to do the dumbest thing first because it might work and then you'll feel smart. Okay? We could try, well, this is the hard thing. This is the full factorization. So Z sub K, capital Z sub K, is that long vector of ones and zeros of all the features that we're seeing at this particular scene. Okay, so there's lots of elements in there. So we could factor it like that. And there's many other factorizations using the chain rule here. There's many ways we could factor it. Well, and that seems a bit hard. I don't know how ever I would ever learn PZ1 conditioned on 19,999 other variables. I don't really fancy my chances at learning that. So you go, oh, okay, let's throw the true solution out and let's just try naive Bayes. Let's say I could factor this distribution as the product of seeing Z1 given L1 times probability of Z2 given L1. So let's hope that the words all occur independent. The words are independent. Oh dear, big trouble. Now here's why. If you do this, okay, it says that these two places are very, very similar. Okay? No, they're not. It's just that they've got leaves. Okay? And the point is, if you see one leaf, I expect to see 10,000, because leafy things have leaves. Okay? They don't occur just by themselves. Okay? If you see one brick, I expect to see lots of bricks. So don't get all excited if you go, lots of bricks, lots of bricks, lots of leaves, it must be the same place. No, because these things co-occur. Okay, so we're going to have to somehow capture that words are correlated. Okay, so how are we going to do that? That sounds tricky. Well, what I'd like to do then is, could I learn some factorization that looks like Z1 given Z2 times, or Zi given Zj times Zq given Zp. In terms, could I factor it in terms of first order conditionals? So would I have a Z on the right hand side of the conditioning bar? Because that would be kind of cool, because then I'm capturing that these things may be correlated and they might not be independent. Well, that's not so good, because if I have n words, there's n to the n minus 2 possible ways of factoring that. And n, don't forget, is 20,000. So I'm still not fancying my chances. However, Chow and Liu in 1968, great, wrote down a fancy algorithm for doing this. Okay, and they wrote down a nice algorithm that said, if I have a bunch of random variables, how to factorize their joint using just first order marginals. It allows you to factor those two up. And it works in a very elegant way, and it's very intuitive when you understand what they're doing. They say, make yourself a big graph, okay? Make yourself a clique where every node is a word for us. So every word is Z, little Z. So I have 20,000, a graph with 20,000 members, and I have 20,000 connections. Each node connects to all other 19,999 words. The edges between them are the mutual information. I calculate the mutual information between word I and word J. Now, I can do that by counting. If I just built a big table, a co-occurrence table, for Zi and Zj, just by counting and summing columns and summing rows, I can calculate the mutual information. So thick lines here, to us, mean that they have big mutual information. And then what I do is you walk the maximal spanning tree. You calculate the maximal spanning tree for that graph, and then just by the parent rule, you can read off the factorization. And the brilliant thing is that factorization is the best factorization in the sense of minimizing the KL distance to the true distribution. So that's a nice result, okay? And that's useful. So here, we can do this, okay? And we do, and we wrote a computer program to do it. And here's a visualization of what happens. This is, for example, word 978, okay? And here's an image where 978, every time word 978 is occurring, is being lit up in a Georgian window here. And here is the exemplars of word 978. And look, the thing that's most correlated to that is word 995, which is the other side of the window. See top left of window, you see bottom right of window. And we see this again and again and again. It's learning the co-occurrence. Offline, this is offline, learning the co-occurrence between these words. So, and then if you see those windows, you then tend to see the house that it's in as well. Okay, and the words that correspond to the houses that possess these windows, and so on down through the tree. Okay, so now what I've managed to do is I've come up with a way for this. Just to recap, what have we done? We have calculated this guy. Okay, I've got an observation function now. I've got an observation model for my appearance, and that's nice, and that's new. Okay, next thing is, to evaluate whether I'm at the new place or not, I need to worry about this partition function. I need to worry about the denominator of that Bayes rule, which was zk given z super k minus 1. Well, that seems hard to evaluate. One thing I could do is I have my observation function, I could integrate out all places. So forget these two summations, just forget that. Imagine this is just one summation, and I'm integrating out over places. So evaluate the likelihood over all known places, okay, all conditioned on my previous k minus 1 observations, and that would equal that. The problem is, one of these places that I have to evaluate is this new place. So I've got to evaluate the likelihood of an observation coming from a place I've never seen, because I haven't been there. I have to evaluate over all possible places, which must include all the places I've never been to. So this doesn't feel very promising at the moment. What I could do is I could split that integral into two parts. I could integrate over all the places I've been to before, okay, and that's the yellow. And then what's left is, so that's an easy thing to do. I can do that, I can evaluate, because I have these, okay, I have an idea of where I've been from my previous time step and my probability of being at each of these places from a previous time step. And I can evaluate this, the probability of this observation coming from each of those places. I can do that. That's what my sensor model does me. This, though, still looks a bit daunting, because it's now summing over still all the places I've never been. But here's a trick. I've got that Chow Liu tree. And Chow Liu trees are very easy to sample from. So what I could do very, very quickly is generate a view from a random place that I've never seen before, simply by sampling from that tree. So I could fire that tree and go sample down that tree, and it generates me an observation vector that's from a place I've never been to. But that place is representative of all the training data, and that training data is supposed to be the kind of places we're working in. So by sampling, I could sample from my Chiaolu tree to come up with observations from places I've never been, because that Chiaolu tree encapsulates the generation of observations from all places. So just by sampling from that tree, I can come up with a very cheap way to do that. And that's a very powerful technique. So we're almost there. We're almost there. So the next thing is, I've now evaluated the probability of being at each of these places in my map. And let's say I call it and say, well, you're 90% confident you're at this place. Now I can update my model for that place. I can use the observation to update the model. I now use Bayes' rule. The details are not really important for this talk, but you could believe the details are there in the paper. I can now update the probability of existence of the generators at each of those places. So if every time I came through a place, I saw line, okay, word 9007 I called it, I should increase my belief that there is a generator at place I of word 9007. And so I can start to do an update, and so the circle is closing. So that's the... Yes, hello.
So when you're sampling from your Chiaolu tree, how do you account for the fact that you're double counting all of this? It's the Chiaolu tree.
The Chiaolu tree is built offline. Right. It's static. It isn't being changed by my experience in this run.
But it represents everything that you've observed, right?
Yeah, but not the new stuff I've observed. It's static. We fix it. It doesn't represent... I think that's a great question. You're saying... you're double counting the places you've just seen a few seconds ago, yeah? Yeah, they're not ever fed into the Chiaolu tree.
Okay.
Yeah, and you never run in the place you trained. So I think we're safe from double counting. Yeah, we're safe. That's a good question. Right, okay. Right, so now we get to the fun bit of some results. Okay, hello.
Are you updating all places or just the...
No, here we're greedy at this time. We just update the best one. Yeah, we say, yeah, we have a threshold, whatever you want it to be, 1 in 10 million. Yeah, I mean, the numbers, well, here you go, the numbers are pretty up against 0 and 1 here. This is the probability that these places are the same, okay, coming out of the FabMap algorithm. And here you go, here's a nice sort of Harry Potter-esque view with the bicycle. The bikes have gone here, but it's still saying, yeah. Absolutely convinced this is the same place. How so? Well, because if the pedals go, the wheels go. If the wheels go, the handlebars go. If the handlebar goes, the saddle goes, so I'm not surprised. Okay, and that's what's happening. That's how this is working. Here you go, here's another person walking. So there you go, that's Hogwarts is just to the left here. It really is. This is, we'll see it in a minute. The person goes, and generally, if people's heads disappear, their arms go with them. Okay, and so that's what we've learned, because we've trained data and we've seen lots of people, and the words that correspond to faces co-occur with the words that correspond with maybe shoulders, and shoulders correspond with hands. And we've got lots of data, and they all disappear together. And here's a similar one. So constant high confidence despite scene change when places are distinctive. But I think this is more interesting. It's the spatial aliasing that is really, really so painful in the SLAM problem, of saying, you have come back to the same place. You have, and actually it's lying, and you just haven't. Okay, so seeing brick walls and going, brick wall, I saw a brick wall a while ago. You know, you must be back at the same place. That's stupid, because brick walls are everywhere. It's perceptual aliasing, we've got to nail this. And this, it isn't really zero, forgive me, it's actually 1 × 10⁻⁶, okay, but it just, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done that. And it's saying, yeah, okay, I'm not at all surprised, because I'm sort of anthropomorphizing what it's to do. It's a bit risky doing that with an algorithm, but I'm trying to give you some intuition. It's saying, well, lots of bricks co-occurring isn't very distinctive, because you see the top right of a brick, yeah, whatever. I always see the bottom right. They always co-occur. So lots of these bricks turning up, they're all correlated anyway, so it's not such a big deal. So it's just not enough to say that those are the same place. But actually, and I expect it saying these are quite different. So no, I'm not buying it, because it's all brick. Similarly here, it's saying, well, yeah, hedges and bricks, all the words and hedges co-occur and bricks, and quite often I get hedges on bricks. Not so good. This, it says, well, maybe 0.74. And that's a very low probability for us. We'd never fire on 0.74. We'd never say that's a loop closure. And here's the difference between using the FabMap algorithm and the Chiaolu tree. The naive Bayes here, it's the difference using FabMap and naive Bayes for the likelihood function. would say, okay, so there's lots you can't quite see here, the lighting's not quite right. There are lots of features up here that have disappeared, and naive Bayes would go, well, loads of stuff has disappeared. Okay, but really what the FAB map, using the Chow Lu tree, it says, yeah, okay, but it's windows, so the windows all disappear together. Okay, so I still think it's the same place, and yeah, there's massive differences here. Naive Bayes says, they're just no way the same place, because where do those people go? And this says, yeah, the people go, and guess what? Their heads and their hands, they all went as an integrated unit, okay, as we like for happy living. Okay, right. And here's some precision recall curves. It's good to have these. The paper really nails all the performance metrics, so you shouldn't believe me with these fancy pictures, but we've got some nice ROC curves. And note the scale. This one starts at 0.5, so we're getting 100% precision up until 0.4 recall. And then it falls off for two quite large data sets. The data sets have been, it's going to press in IGRR, and the data sets are being released with hand-labeled ground truth. So you can try this out on the real data sets. Okay, so here you go. It's nice, because what we can now do is we're getting a histogram out of the probability of being at each of I places. So if I have 10,000 places, it's a histogram of 10, well, it's a PDF with 10,001 bins. And the last bin is probability of a new place. And so we can decide to threshold that as if they are probability of 1 in 10,000, okay, and just say those are loop closures. And here's a GPS trajectory of the robot going, it's crappy GPS in Oxford for some reason. And you can see these loop closures. What's nice, though, is if you turn that dial down to, say, 1 in 100, so an error of 1 in 100, you do start to get those errors. And that's quite nice to count. And the numbers are pretty fair. If you say, give me 2 in 1,000 errors, you'll get about 2 in 1,000. It might be 2 in 8,000. Okay, so, well, that's good, but can't we be cleverer? You see, we'd like at this point, it was taking about 60 microseconds, so 60 milliseconds to calculate, to compare places. And if we had 10,000 places, that was being too slow for us. We needed to go faster. So we had to think, and we thought, I've got this graph of places, each of these places. And for each of these, I have to evaluate Z1, Z2, Z3, the probability of these conditioned on L1, through all of them. So what we used to do is calculate the Chow Lu tree for all of that, great, and evaluate the likelihood of PLI given Z for this guy, and then for this guy, and then for this guy. But we can be cleverer. Instead of being exhaustive for each place, okay, what we could do is do it kind of breadth first. Evaluate part of the likelihood for each of the places. Instead of completely evaluating one place, evaluate part of the likelihood term, one of these products of Zi given Zj, for each of the places. And we can do it in order of informativeness. So we can say, okay, which of these words are the rarest? Look for those guys first. And which are the second rarest? And look at all of those guys across all the places. Okay, so, and then you can start to think, you could do a graph of the log likelihood for each of the places against the number of words that you have evaluated. So up here, right up here, I've evaluated the PZI given ZJ for all words for all places. And up here, maybe I've only evaluated 10. So I've done 10 of these. Oh, you can't really see that. You must have wondered what I was writing in a red pen. Okay, I've only evaluated 10 of those terms per place. So I want to be lazy and stop evaluating those places when it looks like I've got a clear winner and there's no chance it's going to be overtaken because it's so far ahead in the race. You may as well turn the Grand Prix off because you know Schumacher's going to win. Okay, because he's 50 laps ahead. Okay, and there's a slight chance that he's going to come off the track, but really it's boring at this point. And that's the exact analogy of what we're doing here. So imagine, define S as the relative shift between competing hypotheses. Okay, if we did in fact remain the remaining terms. So that's, we're going to stop at time K, and S is the shift between the leader and one of the other guys that would have happened if we carried on evaluating the rest of them. What I'd like to know is what is the probability of S being greater than delta, okay? Because a delta is the distance between the current leader and everybody else, okay? And if that probability is very, very small, I could just stop, okay? So what I want to do is, if S is this sum, I want to find the probability that S is greater than this delta, because if it's very small, I could just stop. Okay. And it turns out there's a thing called the Bennett bound that solves this very nicely. And the Bennett bound says that so long as the symbols, the modulus of the symbols coming up are bounded, that's true, they are, because I know I've got the, I'm evaluating the symbols in decreasing order. Okay, and there's a bound on the variance, and it turns out we can put an easy bound on the variance. Let S be the sum of all these terms, so this is my random variable. The Bennett bound gives the probability of S being greater than delta as less than this fancy thing. Isn't that extraordinary? Okay, so what we can do is now we can solve to find out what that delta must be for a probability of abandoning the race and then losing, of being less than small number. Okay, because we want to abandon the race now. Say, well, I'd like to abandon the race when the probability of the guy who's winning at the moment not being the winner, had I not been lazy, is very, very small. Yeah? Okay. And turns out we can do that. And we get really astounding speeds up. So speed ups effective 16.8, 12.3, 27.7 on our data sets. It's really good. So we're now down to of the order of 60 microseconds per image compared per place evaluation. So it's now brought us slightly sublinear because we're now doing this breadth first search and we can bail. Okay, and with only a, this is FabMap, this is the vanilla one when you evaluate the likelihood exhaustively, and AbFabMap, accelerated Bayesian FabMap, okay, or binited FabMap, we only get a slight decrease in recall here. Okay, so I think I have some videos to finish the talk off with, and videos are always good. These videos are also going up as part of the multimedia extensions on the paper. So, robot collects images left and right. Okay, those are the images you're seeing here, left and right. And loop closures are going to show up here. And along here is the PDF, and you see the scale is changing as it sees 120 places, 160 places. Okay, PDF exceeds a threshold, there's a loop closure, and it's showing there. Okay, this actually is, if you've seen Harry Potter, this is Hogwarts schoolyard. Okay. It's nice to go around and do Harry Potter-like experiments with magic. Okay, and there's the PDF. Look, you see, this one's quite big. This one up here is not showing. We should have the new place one in. See, it's really saying, it's copying these loop closures here. It really is. It's 0.9999999, according to itself, that these are the same places. And these are fairly visually ambiguous places, right? Okay, there's just lots of antiquities. So it goes around the quad, no loop closures, new place, new place, new place the whole time. And this is quite ambiguous. Look, you know, it's seeing lots of stuff at the same. Now, interesting, when it comes round, it doesn't fire immediately because false negatives aren't as worrying for us as false positives. You're starting to see some peaks, look, but they're not firing. They're not enough because it says, well, I've seen all these windows before and I've seen this kind of structure. There's nothing really distinctive. And then suddenly it goes, ah, yeah, got it. Okay, off, and then round. Do you want to see this video play some more, or do you want to see another data set? Another data set? Yeah? More. Well, it's more data this way too, but different data. Okay. Yeah. What does happen, let me tell you, is it goes all the way around here, no, all the way around the garden to the other side, and then back in, and guess what? It starts going red again. Okay. So here is a city centre data set, slightly different. It's topological mapping, no metric information. Here goes, same stuff again. And this data the video is made from is, I said, the images, you know, absolutely as they are up on the website for you to try and use with sort of handheld with GPS, because the GPS doesn't work in all these places. And here's the kind of numbers of features we're seeing, like there are lots, right? Okay, there you go, it's been here before. And we're off. Okay. All right, well, some summary slides, perhaps. Oh, yeah. All good slam talks do have to have gratuitous 3D maps in it these days, okay? So here are some gratuitous maps. So we've gone around that quad, and I had the 3D laser going, okay? And it fires a loop closure. And I've done okay slam around there. It's quite large scale. The laser only sees up to, like, 30 meters or something. So, and I get this typical affair of it spots it at the loop closure, okay? And it's done one update. But the maps aren't really aligning because I've corrected here, but there are errors from down here that haven't been propagated. So I need to do some optimization. Okay, so I now say I've got another constraint. Oh, who of you metric poses are now close because I've enforced this topological constraint? Oh, you guys have now pulled together. I need to do the optimization again, relinearize. Oh, anyone new? So I propagate this like stitching wavefront out over the graph of places, trying to see if they're approaching other neighbors that they weren't close to before. So now we're propagating that topological information back through metric. We have the independent system saying, hey, you're where you were before, even though you didn't know it, you are. And we're propagating that round, and then we end up having done that with quite a nice 3D picture of quite large scales. Okay, so the summary. Appearance-based information has, we believe, an enormous contribution to be made in supporting familiar metric navigation techniques, and I think it should be independent. Particularly useful at the large-scale end of the navigation problem, we're currently running FabMap on data sets of 300 kilometres with some, but not crippling pain. We haven't got the 300-kilometre result yet. We think we know why. We're up against a 32-bit memory issue. I have to go to 64-bit and so a few other issues. But this is... Hello.
Just a clarification. It's 300 kilometres of untraveled terrain, or is it 300 kilometres by repeating?
It's from Oxford down to the far southwest of England, different motorway on the way back, travelling at 70 kilometres an hour.
So the loop is the distance travelled?
The total, it says, the thing's interesting is the total number of images, and then we cross through intersections on motorways and then carry on, and then we've also done some urban stuff as well to make sure those loop closures fire. And I'd like to talk about why it's not working, perhaps in questions about really, you know, why you shouldn't believe this is everything solved. We've come a long way, but... I think the contributions are formulating a coherent probabilistic framework for inference from appearance is central, putting this probabilistically and getting the sensor model folded in there, and particularly the use of the Chow-Liu tree for learning word dependencies is important. And it's I think it's the natural and orthogonal complement to metric approaches. It's better coverage, I think, of the navigation problems, having topological appearance-based and hardcore metric at the same time. I sleep easier at night because of that. And they typically have different failure modes. So take-home contributions, order n computation, a bit less than order n if you have the Bennett band in there as well. Key contributions, evaluation of new place, given the observations, and that was a hard thing to nail. Compact learned representation of the observation joints, so the Chow-Liu tree is approximating a 10, 20,000D distribution just as a product of marginals, and that's nice. It's not anchored to any particular or number of modalities. There's nothing to say that these likelihoods, these words have to be visual. They could be spatial words. They could be, you know, you can have a vocabulary of spatial signatures. It doesn't have to be SIF descriptors. It could be spatial descriptors. It could be spin images, whatever you need. It's trivial to parallelize, not in the Bennett band case, but in the FabMap case, because you can evaluate the probability of each of these places independently. And we've used it in supporting a 3D SLAM system. It is extensible to scene labeling. I'd love to talk to you about that. We are using it for semantic labeling, the same technology, and that's a lot of fun. And we are interested and happy to export the binaries to interesting folk on whatever platform you want with a Socket API, and you just send us images, and we'll send you back a histogram of whether we think you've been there. Well, that pretty much nails it in 52 minutes, so sorry if I overran, and it's been a real pleasure. Any questions? And I would be delighted.
First, so I guess, Paul, I heard you when you said it's sort of agnostic for sensor modality, but can you say a little bit about the relative performance of LiDAR and camera?
No, because we gave up on using it with the LiDAR. What we did, we ran the N-cubed one using LiDAR, and it's okay. The problem is, I've tried to push Mark towards doing this, but we haven't done it with the LiDAR because we haven't found any good shape descriptors. They're anything like as discriminative and high-dimensional as the SIFT or the SURF. I have thought about doing it with sonar. That would be kind of cool, you know, with images from side-scan sonar. But if you have a vocabulary or you have a bunch of data and you can give descriptors of the scenes, the binaries that we're going to ship, they don't actually take in images. They just take in vectors of the words. They don't know what the words came from.
Was it 3D later data
scan? It was 2D, and we just used signatures like that.
Was it indoors? Was it an interesting scene?
It was indoors and outdoors, yeah. It was the cloisters. But this thing is just working so well with the vision. I mean, we're like, well, let's stick with that for now. Hi, yeah.
What's the depth or diameter of the tree? Of the chow?
Of the, what? The
of the tree, the depth or diameter?
I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know. I can find out. I don't want to say something glib. We can sample from it very, very fast. So it's a binary tree, right? It's at every stage, it's, yeah. I'm sorry, I haven't given you a very good answer there, but I'll get back to you on that. That's don't want to be glib. Yes, Sanjay.
What's the intuition for this thing to be a tree, in the sense that I would think of, you know, I understand why sections of it might be a tree, right? But what I would have expected out of this would have been lots of trees, lots of little trees that are sort of correlated in the way that...
But the problem is posed and says, how can I... We pose the problem of saying, what is the best approximation using a tree, a single tree? That's how the Chow-Liotu algorithm works. It says, I shall factorize... Are we going to go? Let me just show it. It's going to take a while to scoot through. I say, what is the choice of I's and J's and parents if I want to minimize the distance, the KL, between a distribution that is represented by this tree and the full joint? So, in other words, I can't really answer that question because you say, you shall factor it this way. What's the best choice?
What is the intuition for that, that there should be a single spanning tree that goes through your entire...
Because we could... you're asking, why did I want to choose a single tree?
That's right.
It's because I can count and I can calculate first order marginals from a co-occurrence table. And the data is very, very sparse. So if I had 20,000 table by 20,000, I can come up with co-occurrence between pairs. But I don't think I have enough data to learn Z1 given Z2 and Z3. It's just too sparse in the training data. So that's why we said, now you could absolutely try and say, wow, if only we had more data, we could come up with thicker trees and we could come up with thicker junction trees. This is a width one junction tree. We could come up with thicker trees. But it's very hard to get dense enough training data to do that. Maybe we could learn a couple of marginals, but we don't know of any algorithm that would give us that junction tree that we could learn like the Chow-Liotu does. It's a counting problem. You just don't get enough co-occurring data. Yeah. Hi.
So, you know, obviously there's a natural discretization here. So how far apart do your places...
Oh, yeah, right.
...show up? How do you handle the transition?
Yeah, and we're being really dim here about this. We know we want to work on that. At the moment, we say, if you move 7 meters, take a picture. Yeah, but what we should be doing is having a stream coming in, and an RA in my group, Derek Schroeder, is working on this, have streaming data coming in and looking for metrics to say, this is new placey, this is interesting, you should drop a new place here. And it's not clear the best way necessarily to do that. Yeah, but yeah, you don't do it every second because that's just stupid. But we just move, so you know, moving on the, mounted a ladybug on a car and drove it at 70 kilometers an hour, and I think we had a GPS just telling us where we were for ground truth, and then just firing every few meters and taking those photos. Yeah, but what is a place is interesting, very interesting. Hi, yeah.
Can you tell us a little more about the, I guess you run this in real time,
yep.
I guess I'm wondering about the computational time, how fast you run it.
Yeah, so we were down at British Aerospace 3-4 weeks ago, and we're running around their test site sitting in the back of a disco, and it was going, they were driving at about 20 kilometers an hour, I guess, and it was sitting there quite happily ticking along. So it's much faster than real time because it's about 60 to 100 microseconds per place, I believe. So if you have a couple of thousand places, it's evaluating all those. It's not struggling to keep up. It's really not. We have timing information. I can give it to you afterwards. I have the max and the mean timing information on my computer for different data sets if you want. So we have the worst case and the best case.
They said 60 to 100 microseconds.
Microseconds. Yeah, per place. Yeah. So if you've got 10,000 places, that builds up, right? Because you've got to evaluate that over 10,000 places. Yeah. But the Bennett band is very helpful. What's really interesting is if Mark was saying, you know, as you go through down the motorway and you go under motorway bridges, the computation time peaks because the words aren't discriminative enough and it has to do more of this search. In turn, you know, the probability of being overtaken by the current loser is quite big until you've done a much more of an exhaustive search. So the computation peaks, and that's quite interesting. We've also just taken the data from the vocabularies learned outdoors and just run it through data on a handheld camera as well. See if it works indoors, and it does. So you just hold a handheld camera, wander through a building, and lights up when you come back to the same places. And that was interesting for us because the vocabularies seem to be more descriptive than we were expecting. Yeah.
Just to make sure I understand that. So you're basically going through your history of places, so 600 microseconds per
place. Yeah, no, not the whole algorithm running in 60 microseconds. That would be too joyous to express. Yeah. I think Harry had a question, yeah?
Yeah, So the topological map that you form,
yeah.
Most of the nodes have two edges coming out of it?
Yeah, most of them do. That's right.
Yes, I pictured right.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So then, have you thought about how to use your topological map to inform exploration?
We would love to. And we haven't thought about it. No, we would love to. There's all kinds of things we could do. So what we'd like to do is, if we're at a node, what's the probability that there's an unknown node coming off this node? So if we could get some indication that there's a crossroad, for example, then maybe it makes sense to look around for that crossroad. Yeah. Yeah, Al.
I was wondering about the relationship between the number of places and the excursion over which you do the test. And that led me to think, you know, there's probably a higher probability of a place which is new being, in fact, a loop closure. Because intersections have a lot of intersections.
That's right. That's absolutely right.
That might be a way to extend it by.
That's absolutely right. And we have this you know, hidden in the detail in here is a motion model that says, okay, how do I predict what place I might now, given all my previous observations? And we say, most likely, same place, slight probability, new place, slight probability, or some probability, a previous place you've been to. And there's our motion model. Now, what would be good if that motion model was somehow dependent on what we're seeing, and we have been seeing recently, if it's crossroad-like, okay? And also the characteristics of the place we've just previously been at. Whether, you know, we've got some indications, if there's lots of traffic signs, that would be a clue. Yeah.
So as a follow-up to Al's question,
yeah.
When you come to a cross-section, what happens when you come at a very, very different perspective?
That's fine, so long as you do see stuff in common. Don't forget, we're not using perspective, it's just, do the words occur? It's not where they are in the image at all. It's just, do I see these many words? It doesn't matter.
So have you found examples where words don't occur from different perspectives?
Oh yeah, or loads. I mean, we don't have perfect region of interest detectors, absolutely not. You know, the wide baseline stability is not what you want. What really hurts us is when the sun sets behind a building, yeah? Then our region of interest detectors simply aren't firing on things they fired in the morning. So they, you know, went out for like 6 hours driving and came back, and the sun in England only is up for like 3 hours of the day anyway. Things had, we're pretty pleased the sun's up, don't laugh, it's a good day if you're seeing it. It wasn't firing as much as it should on the way back, and that's an issue. And because we're not addressing computer vision dynamic range here, we've got low dynamic range cameras, we are exposed to all of those problems, absolutely. Yeah, but you know, on the videos there, you can see it was coming in on quite different angles through things, and it does light up. Not always, and that's a good point. We're not worried so much about false negatives. We don't necessarily mind missing loops. What we really mind about is false positives, because when we've got a loop closure, we can then say, okay, let's stitch the metric back from this, and the metric can help us. And then we can say, okay, we have a better metric map. But what we don't want to do is inform, have false positive loop closures, because then you're really up a creek. Hello.
If you want to run, include information like visual and auditory, you know, cafeteria sound different from library sound different from open spaces.
Yeah.
Would you want a parallel system, or would you try to
incorporate? Am I understanding, do you really mean auditory, or is that a metaphor?
No, I mean like, yeah, you hear noise patterns.
Yes. Oh, I see. Oh, you're thinking about using features that are sound-based features. Hey, that's quite cool. Yeah, that would be quite interesting, wouldn't it? I mean, crossroads must sound different than motorways. Yeah, that's interesting. And yeah, it's a good idea. Also, there's a hierarchy we can put in here. I mean, if you're going through lots of places and it all looks motorway-ish, you should condense all of those places into a symbol that means motorway. And I was just down at Texas with Ben Kuipers, and he was hitting me over the head with this again and again. You know, why so many places when you go down a motorway? Topologically, it's motorway. It doesn't mean anything till the next exit. Yes, of course. Yes, we should do that. And I promise we'll try. Yeah. Hi. Yeah,
what
Nate.
What about environments where you don't have good prior data? About, I guess it would be kind of combining an online learning of the tree.
What? Oh, right. Yes. Now, we've read some stuff about this. People trying to do this. That would be great. That would be great if you could build your tree online. We've not tried it. And the reason we thought about it, and the reason we haven't, is our vocabulary seemed to be so multinational. You know, very surprisingly, I didn't expect the vocabularies to work indoors at all. And they do.
But the probability distribution is
So suddenly you go to a place where you get traffic cones in every tree because there's a lot of students. Yeah? Yeah? Okay? So what you should start to learn is that most trees come with leaves and traffic cones. And yeah, is that the kind of thing you're meaning? Yeah? And you should be updating your Chao Lu tree because of that. That would be cool. But I don't think we could sensibly do that if we chose to use the Chao Lu tree, because I think it's quite hard to learn. It's not a small job. It's an overnight piece of computation. What I would like to do is switch vocabularies when needed. Yeah? So you go, this is feeling a bit French. You know, this is feeling, oh, wherever you're going, and I'm going to learn, I'm going to have different terms of reference. And you should be like that. I don't understand anything that is being said. You know, so you have to start using different languages, and that might be quite interesting. We haven't really seen the need for that. But I feel the vocabulary generation is a big black box that we should be looking at a lot better. We should be doing feedback for how well we're doing for what the vocabulary is. Barely scraping the surface on that, and that's quite exciting. Yeah, right at the back.
So what is exactly word in your case?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear the question.
What is exactly word in your case?
What is exactly a word in your case?
So you're using the inverse document frequency.
Yes, I confused you there. I talked about inverse document frequency because I was talking about what words are. This actually is a set of words, if you like, so it's either 0 or 1 if it turns up. To answer your question about what is a word, it's just something that was a, we took data, because people gave us descriptors, I don't know where they came from, we clustered them, and the center of those clusters were words. And they have the dimension of whatever the descriptor of the region of interest in the scene was. So what are we really using here in the results I showed you? Those were Harris-affine regions of interest with a surf descriptor, is what we're using in the concrete examples there.
So word is the same word or
a bit? There's a very strange acoustic effect. I think there's like a phase shift of exactly pi.
So word then is the centroid of your vector description?
Words are a centroid of your vector description?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thanks. But the strange thing is that he can hear it. So this is a seat of wisdom. Yeah, there. I mean, in many ways, the clustering is also wide open. I mean, I used a simple leader follows to start with, and I think Mark at the moment is running on a big k-means to see if he can come up with a better vocabulary. We do kind of check that the vocabulary follows Zipf's law as well. You should log frequency, log occurrence, should be kind of a straight line with a negative gradient, and broadly it is, just to check things have gone well. Yeah, hey.
In the scene that has changed. If you take this to a genuinely boring periodic environment like San Jose, learn that it can never close loops, or will it make mistakes?
What we're seeing, and we're looking into this on very large data sets, is its ability to close loops when you have truly large, boring data sets that aren't repeating gets diluted with size, because there's a bit of the PDF being given to each of them, and we're seeing that. So I'd like to try it. I don't know if I really want to have to go to that tang, but if you could go there and go to this boring place and send us, we'd be interested. Okay, so let's lead on. Let's say, where does this thing fail? Kurt Kunlige sent us some data of a robot on scrubland, just going through brush. We don't expect it to work there. Okay, we're having a look. But you know, there will be problems. Realistic about it, there will be problems with that. It's not the panacea, but I think it's pretty damn good. Mark has done a fantastic job. He really has. Got some more questions? These are great questions. I'm feeling mildly exercised by them.
This is one stupid, irrelevant question to your main talk. But I wonder why your range data have seems to be. If you show the range data.
Oh. I'll play it, hang on. I can be revolutionary and play it. Why is that not playing?
I see a little bit of, how should I say?
Striping?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's because we're nodding it. The laser is going up and down and doing that. And so it spends quite a lot of time on the ground. And then as it's going through there, it's going quite fast. So you get the striping effect. Is that your question?
Where does it come from?
Because the laser's nodding. It's a sick laser that I've stuck on a windscreen wiper motor, reciprocating. And it's going up and down, and it's not, the velocity isn't controlled to give constant spatial sampling. The velocity is controlled by sticking 24 volts on it. Literally, I don't mean to be facile, but we said, well, okay, and then we regretted doing that because we then had to spend 2 months trying to do very accurate timing from a windscreen wiper motor. But yes,
it so seems like every three lines, I think there was a.
Oh, I see. Well, that's because you're saying that it's denser here, and then here, and then here, and then here. Yeah, that,
right,
why does
now
it?
I understand it.
Well, that will be an alien.
This is coming at the constant speed. Then on the ground, it may be not a constant separation.
That's right, it's not. So it's sort of down, and they're moving forward as we're moving, and then you're going to get these denser areas, so you're going to get these waves breaking where it's been covered twice or three times.
Yeah, but in one of the displays, I saw the frequency seems to be three. Every three lines, I saw some sort of repetitiveness.
Really? That's interesting.
Somehow I felt that.
Huh. Well, I'll look at that again and try and... And now, I mean, yeah, I think that's interesting, but yeah, I don't know what else to say, really. I mean, no, it's great. No, we get crazy A-listing essays, and I didn't mean to be glib with the 24-volt thing, but that really is the dumb things that we did, yeah. Yeah. Anything else?
Well, did you want somebody to ask about the limitations?
I was going to tell you, I started to say where
I'm asking you later.
Yeah, I mean, I've sort of spoken about some of the things that it breaks on. We have issues. We're up against 32-bit memory. Okay, so if you're going to do really huge runs, that's starting to hurt. We're up against building sensible vocabularies for these huge spaces that we want to do. So we want to build words with many, many thousands of vocabularies, and clustering is quite hard in that space. And we're up against just the normal stuff, I guess, of computer vision, of just things look different under radically different lighting conditions. And that's kind of hard, and that's hurting. So if the lights go dim, or you get very strong shadows being cast across buildings, that causes us trouble. So sometimes coming back after a long run, Mark was showing me data, and basically he was just picking up features on the skyline and nothing to do with the buildings. And I guess that's a problem that we all have. And if you guys can fix it, excellent. But like I say, I'm a guy with no vision.
So it seems if you take the laser rangefinder data or something, you then take out that color problem, color constancy, and all that stuff from computer vision. So do you think by combining it with laser rangefinder?
Yeah, we would love to, and we have.
I know you have to find features.
Yes, we would absolutely love to do that. That would be great. And also maybe even learn different sensor models for different lighting conditions. That would be kind of cool as well. That sensor model's fixed. You should be saying, what are the parameters of this thing to make this thing run so well? Well, let's be clear, there are three parameters. There's a noise, there's a motion model parameter to say the probability of being a new place, given I'm at a place that's known, and two sensor model parameters. Probability of seeing something when it wasn't there, and the probability of not seeing something when it was there. And those are the three parameters. Of those, it's only sensitive to the latter two, the sensor models, and you can dial that. Well, we'd like to roll it out and have guys abuse it and say this doesn't work in these conditions, and then have a look and fix it. That would be good. Hi, yeah.
So it surprised me that it's only those two parameters and not the probability of seeing one of the words or not seeing one of the words. It's across all the words.
Yeah, and that's a great question. I mean, another thing we should be saying is, well, that was a bit gross, wasn't it? And it was a bit gross to say it's probability of seeing a word given it exists or not, independent of what the word is, because leafy words might blow around and not be so reliable as traffic cones, of course, unless the traffic cones are in the trees, which we already talked about. But you know, we could try to look at learning that, so we thought about sticking a camera just looking for hours and days at traffic going past, and it would be nice, wouldn't it, if we could learn that these kind of features tend to be on people and their heads and arms move, and these are on cars, and they tend to move as well. And so you should have a different sensor model for those, and that would probably help. I mean, what are the failure conditions? We had this very fancy lorry that was driving around Oxford and had some crazy pattern on the side, and I think there's failure cases in the paper. And it was a really extraordinary looking lorry, and of course then it turned up in another part of Oxford 2 kilometers away the next day. They go, oh, I've never seen anything like that, it's extraordinary. You know, and it, with all the priors in the world and all the estimation, it was still just like, that is just such an astounding lorry. You're at the same place. It has comedy, but it's frustrating if you know, then your map's really broken. So what we should be doing after that is when we fuse with a metric, if we're going to do a metric update, is go, well, can I calculate a fundamental matrix here between these two views? And can I decompose that sensibly? And that's what actually what Andrew Zisserman and his crew are doing on their database search stuff at the moment. Yeah. Yeah. So.
It seems like at least in that case, you actually run into the problem that like, you've never seen that car before. It looks completely ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's like a car, right? Even though, you know, you've conditioned on the fact that some.
Yeah, and this is such a crazy co-occurrence of these words. Like, you read some, some phrase ill met by midnight prides time. It's something that, that's just really unique, and you go, well, that's a bit of Shakespeare. It just is. I'm really not expecting to see that anywhere else. And then you do, what are you going to do with that? I guess if we trained, or if that shows up, a paucity of training data, we should have trained it against crazy lorries. Yeah, and we didn't see it. And another thing that I think fired once, if I recall this right, is railings. There was a certain kind of railing, just a certain very strange, ornate kind of Harry Potter railing. And that occurred a couple of times, and I hadn't learned about that. So then we had to show it a bunch of railing data. And what I'd like to do is get towards lifelong learning, whereas every time we bring the robot home, we just upload it to a server, and it reclusters, and the next day we go out, and we've got a bigger and better vocabulary. And that would be very, very cool. That would be quite exciting. And we just need to just do the systems engineering to do that. Just. Okay. Yeah. You know it's not going to work, but yeah. Yeah.
Thanks, Paul, for
what a pleasure. Thank you very much.